language, welcome. A lot of ground to cover tonight in the military update.
Yeah, so I can't get the map app to work at all. It just keeps crashing on me before I even get to the splash screen. So apologies. We probably won't have a map that I can independently control this evening. However, I did throw a link up. So if you're on your phone, you can click on that. It will take you right to the map itself. So you can kind of navigate yourself around. It's the best solution we're going to get this evening. I don't know if there seems to be some connectivity issues on my end or something else. Otherwise, it is a bit of a lengthy update tonight, so strap in. We'll be covering the last couple of days, and there's been a decent amount of activity at the front line. So, unfortunately, maybe we'll pause twice here, and I'll try and retry the map then, but it doesn't seem to be effective. I already restarted my device, and it's not fixing it. But I hope everyone's doing well, as best can be expected. And, yeah, I'm happy to dive in whenever you guys are.
Let's get our feet wet. Go ahead, language.
Okay. This is the military update for April 4th through April 15th, 2024, day 779 through 782 of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Starting in the west and proceeding clockwise, Belarus and the western border, Wagner PMC instructors have completed another training cycle of Russian conscripts in Belarus, where they are using local infrastructure in order to support them. This has been ongoing for a couple of years now, essentially saying, oh, well, if Belarus won't get physically involved, we'll just use their house to and their equipment to do whatever we want in terms of training. Poland is reportedly considering transferring its Soviet-era stockpile of air defense missiles to Ukraine, and will create a cooperation council with Ukraine under Prime Minister Donald Tusk's office. The Polish foreign minister called on the U.S. Congress to rapidly pass aid for Ukraine in the aftermath of this weekend's successful missile defense operation around Israel. Lithuania has reportedly constructed some 600 kilometers of defensive structures on the Belarusian border to deter smuggling. And a 12-year-old Ukraine bilateral amputee from Lviv participated in the Boston Marathon for 5 kilometers, representing this Ukrainian group in Lviv, which has been heavily focused on fundraising for prosthetics such as hers. Moving to central Ukraine, politics of the day. On the 12th, Ukraine intercepted 16 out of 17 Shahed drones and 0 out of 1 cruise missiles, primarily in southwest Ukraine. Previously, a Russian missile strike targeting the Terpilska power plant southeast of Kyiv caused significant damage. Ukraine is increasing the salary of military personnel at the front line, raising the base salary to some $2,500 US with a combat bonus of $1,800 US for every 30 days that you serve. Ukraine is allocating some $67 million US for school bomb shelters in oblasts along the front line from Sumy to Odessa. Kharkiv, Dnipro, and Zaporizhzhia oblasts will receive some $38 million of this. Ukraine is also allocating an additional $98.5 million for defensive fortifications, of which $43 million will be allocated in Kharkiv Oblast. Ukraine intelligence services continue to reiterate that Russia will increase its offensive actions this spring and summer. Ukraine Commander-in-Chief General Sersky commemorated the 10th anniversary of the 2014 anti-terror operation, which was launched by Ukraine against Russian-supported forces in the Donbass today. Over the last week, Russia launched 130 Shahed drones, 80 missiles, and almost 700 glide bombs. Zelensky and other Ukraine politicians made statements equivocating the unified support for Ukraine air defense to the joint operation this weekend, which intercepted Iranian Shaheds, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles en route to Israel, drawing reference to the fact that NATO countries were involved, Article 5 wasn't invoked, and Israel is also not a NATO member. The Ukrainian energy company, Ukrenergo, is requesting that consumers limit energy usage between 7 and 10 p.m. daily to allow for stable power. Ukraine is reportedly seeking to increase its production of Neptune cruise missiles and raising their range to 1,000 kilometers. Ukraine additionally is on track to produce some 1.2 million FPV drones this year, with costs per unit as low as $350. Reportedly, some 300,000 Ukraine citizens work at over 500 defense industries currently. The Washington Post reported that U.S. Vice President Harris brought up concerns about Ukrainian strikes on Russian oil refineries, which annoyed Zelensky's administration and were rebuffed. The Ukrainian National Security Council, among other elements of the Ukrainian political system, explained that this strategy is cost-effective, legitimate under the laws of war, and will continue. Moving to the northeast, towards Sumy, Chernihiv, and Kharkiv region, a Russian recon group was repelled trying to enter Sumy Oblast, while Russian drone strikes killed a truck driver along the border, as well as targeted civilians in Chernihiv Oblast. Russia reportedly shot down a drone over Belgorod. However, in the days prior, a drone hit the Russian Gazprom company offices, Gazprom being the Russian energy concern, the major player for Russian natural gas and exports. Following increased so-called double tap strikes on first responders, especially recently in Kharkiv, the state emergency service is updating its protocols to start mandating increased full coverage body armor, as well as recruiting additional staff to deal with both high angle rescues, such as in hit buildings, as well as power plant strikes. Rotating blackouts continue in Kharkiv Oblast with damage to natural gas distribution recently following Russian strikes. Russian strikes continue around Kharkiv. However, they seem to be more focused on the southeast, targeting a radar decoy to the southeast of the city, as well as to the west in the industrial district with S-300 strikes. Russia is reportedly targeting energy infrastructure specifically linked to large population and industrial centers rather than just anything they can target. Per the Ukrainian government, Russia's desire is, among other things, wanting to force Ukraine to increase the load on its nuclear energy plants in the west of the country, possibly trying to encourage Ukraine to increase their utilization beyond safe operating levels to compensate and thus risk accidents. Moving east to the Kupiansk and Liman region, Russia continues to not launch attacks towards Kupiansk, although we continue to see Ukrainian drone strikes operating towards Russian positions in the northeast. However, there is heavy shelling, especially with airstrikes of the Kupiansk residential district and suburbs. This has led to significant forest fires in the southeast of the city near Kupiansk-Vozlovy. To the southeast of this area, Russia launched four assaults towards Terni from Kremina. There does not appear to have been any significant change on the front line here, with Russian troops increasingly attempting expansive assaults to the northeast of the operating zone instead of direct strikes along their prior line of attack towards the Zarubets River Valley and Terni Highway. It appears that Russia is continuing to have difficulty in direct breakthroughs here, and as such is continuing efforts to expand the front line and seek breakthroughs there. However, Ukrainian artillery has been more active here, as have drones. We'll pause here briefly because Kramatorsk and Bakhmut has some pretty major developments. I'll take any questions.
At language, I read earlier today an ISW assessment was that Russian assaults going west of Kremina had more or less fizzled out. Is this what you're seeing? Would you confirm that?
I don't think they've been as successful as they were a couple months ago. This was an area that Russia put a lot of troops into, and starting at really the beginning of February, started to make some gains, although those do appear to have fizzled out pretty much at, you know, aside from some main minor changes a week later, middle of February, there was some tiny gains at the beginning, so almost a month ago. But this direct strike towards the highway, the valley, that doesn't seem to have progressed, at least for Russia. So they've increasingly pushed further to the northeast, trying to seek some gains there. We've seen this before with Russian forces. It's generally not successful. We saw it earlier on around Avdiivka, where they stretched their forces further to the northwest because their initial breakthroughs didn't work, and those assaults never really materialized into anything super productive. We saw it way back when around Izum when they stretched their forces. This is not a winning strategy statistically for Russia. Even with glide bombs being utilized here, it appears that Ukraine defensive lines are holding them off, at least along the main strip. Remains to be seen how it'll develop, but we've also seen an increased number of Russian vehicle losses here. So this probably isn't going to be particularly fruitful in and of itself.
Language, what is your assessment of Russia's nightly aerial bombardment of Kharkiv? Is Russia attempting to trigger a new refugee crisis? Russia simply intending to obliterate this city of 1.3 million as it has demolished so many other cities in wars it's fought?
I mean, they've been shelling Kharkiv for years now, so the only real major difference I'm seeing now compared to a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, is they've been more successful in taking out the local energy grid. And otherwise, like, that seems to be the goal, to try and prompt some sort of, you know, hysteria, mass evacuation. Currently, Ukraine is able to supply power from other regions, so that's been avoided. There's been very light rebuilding of electrical infrastructure here, bringing more trams online and what have you. I believe a couple weeks ago, Ukraine was saying the Ukraine energy company was saying it would take 2 months to restore the damages here to, you know, a general operable level, and then frankly, probably years to restore the major power plants that were destroyed. I haven't seen, and that was assuming that there's no further damage, which there likely will be. So the situation's challenging, but this also is very much not the first time that Kharkiv's gone through blackouts. It's just been more severe in terms of localized damage to energy infrastructure than in the past.
Robin, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Language, I saw today that they are building new power units at the Khmelnytsky nuclear power plant, and there was a strike in Khmelnytsky Oblast tonight. Just wondering what you think the sustainability of that is, and whether they have adequate protection to be enlarging that nuclear power plant at this point.
So there were goals to enlarge the nuclear power plant that had already been discussed about a month ago, and some of these plans have been around for years. I believe at the time the goal was to add two more reactors from sort of the Russian model to complete the half-built ones, and then actually build two nuclear reactors utilizing American, I think it was Westinghouse, I could be wrong on that, equipment. Those are things that are going to take years to do. So that's not going to be an immediate solution to the problem. It's not really super clear on where the Ukrainian response was about, you know, they're trying to provoke, that Russia's trying to provoke a crisis at the existing nuclear power plants. But the way I interpreted it was that they want Ukraine to try and basically exceed safe operating thresholds at the nuclear power plant. Because then should there be an accident, especially because that plant is really not far from Chernobyl, then it would also, you know, that could cause a decent amount of hysteria. There'd be a lot of political issues and so on and so forth. And it's a way for Russia to cause a crisis without having to physically strike a nuclear power plant. I think there's a lot of speculation there from the Ukraine side, so I can't, you know, comment on how accurate that is or not. But it also probably is shining some light that Ukraine is looking at its more safe, you can imagine, power sources, things that they don't expect Russia directly strike, to try and offset some of this energy deficit.
Thank you.
Thanks, Language. Let's keep going with tonight's military update.
Sure thing. Moving down towards the Kramatorsk and Bakhmut region, where we've seen a considerable amount of change, starting really just south of Krimina and near Severodonetsk, there's been a notable increase in Ukrainian drone strikes northeast of Seversk, with some increase in Russian strikes here as well. Most of the Ukrainian drone strikes are targeting logistical vehicles to the northeast along the axis, where there's been some increase in Russian assaults lately. So they seem to be taking out vehicles before they move to the battlefield themselves. Russia launched a sizable assault to the northeast of Soledar, supported with rocket artillery and drone-connected grenade launchers, to no apparent effect. Russia has reportedly set a goal of May 9th to take Chasiv Yar and is focusing more of its efforts in this direction. Russia launched 27 assaults in this direction the last day, contesting more territory in the Chasiv Yar southeast suburb of Ivanivsky that has been fought over for about a month and a half now, as well as contesting additional territory towards the Ukraine defensive positions near the suburb of Kanal, where they've been also contesting for a couple of weeks. The northeast suburb of Bodanivka is reportedly currently a heavy target for Russian troops, which is a relatively small settlement. There's basically just two streets. Russian forces are known to be occupying the fields to the east, while meanwhile we've seen evidence of Russian and Ukrainian tanks engaging each other at range in the village street. Doesn't appear to have been any major footholds gained here, although Ukrainian forces who are in this region are talking about really heavy usage of drones. Reportedly, there's some 10 drones operating at any time per square kilometer in this general area, split between both sides, and that leads to issues where are we jamming our own drones, or are we jamming the enemy, so on and so forth. Russia's overall goal for Chasiv Yar is to occupy higher terrain so as to threaten territory further to the west. Ukrainian troops report that high amounts of Russian drone coverage, which is complicated movement between buildings, as Russian grenade launchers, automatic grenade launchers, are being liberally used in conjunction with drones for rapid indirect fire, faster than conventional artillery. Russia is reportedly deploying additional VDV forces to this axis, as well as markedly less equipped forces, basically just with entrenching tools, who are chiefly used to advance and rapidly entrench fortifications to be later supported by actual equipped units. Ukrainian Commander-in-Chief General Sirsky reportedly has cracked down on former volunteer heavy units, such as the 67th Brigade, which reportedly had discipline issues with right sector or UDA commanders who had mistreated non-political party members, as well as failing to behave with appropriate military discipline. Previously, these volunteer heavy units have been allowed more latitude, but are now seeing standardization enforced, and especially in recent weeks where apparently they just refused orders, a number of commanders have been reassigned. This gets more into the, sort of the legacy of the 2014 Maidan protests and the volunteers that were more active in 2014-2015, later absorbed into former military units. It seems like there's a little bit more of a crackdown happening now if they don't meet expectations. The situation with Ukrainian medevacs is highly complicated at the front line here by both Russian drone and artillery coverage and the lack of effective armored vehicles for medevac from frontline positions, which are exposed to drones and drone-guided artillery. Combined with other factors, there has been a decrease in effective Ukrainian medical evacuation capacity at the front line. Moving down towards Avdiivka and Pokrovsk, Russia launched some 12 assaults west of Avdiivka yesterday, with focus being to the northwest and southwest of the city. Russia has contested more territory to the northwest of Berdichi, with considerable usage of glide bombs and return Ukrainian strikes on supply lines leading west of Avdiivka. However, Russian troops do not appear to have crossed the river here in force at this time. Russian troops to the southwest continue to advance and contest additional territory west of Toninki near Pervomaisk. There does not appear to be any Russian movement across the river here at this time as well, although further reaching airstrikes and drone strikes on Ukraine positions to the west are noted. There has been an increase in the volume of Russian armored vehicles used during assaults here, as well as less traditional vehicles like motorcycles. The increase in Russian vehicle losses is dramatically apparent at the cost of additional Ukrainian territory. Moving down to Donetsk City and the occupied regions, Russia launched 26 strikes in this general area towards Konstantinivka on the last day with increased cluster bomb and glide bomb strikes on the town. There's been no observed change in front lines here from Novomikhailivka or the Marinka Highway further to the northeast near Pobjeda. Russian forces continue to contest the southeast of Krasnohorivka, which is just north of Marinka, with both Russian and Ukrainian dueling strikes along the southern perimeter of the city. As a reminder, a couple months ago, Russian forces had surged into the southeast sector of the town and then got thrown out by Ukrainian forces, who are apparently attempting to do the same thing. Russia launched a glide bomb on a five-story apartment in Osherton, Donetsk region, unknown amount of casualties buried under the rubble. And the remains of 99 Ukrainian troops, primarily killed in the Donetsk region, were returned this week during an exchange. Moving to Zaporizhia and the southern axis, Russia launched five attacks in eastern Zaporizhia near Staromayorsk. Russia launched 400 strikes on 8 settlements in Zaporizhia, 240 of those being artillery and 144 being drones. There has been a noted increase in Russian rocket and airstrikes around Staromayorsk, which was sort of the eastern aspect of the Ukrainian counteroffensive last summer. Russia has additionally contested territory along the southwest road into Robotne, the main site of the counteroffensive. However, they appear to be impeded by considerable Ukrainian cluster artillery usage on the route, and it's not super clear that Russia has been able to secure any territory, rather just throwing more vehicles at it. Recently, Ukrainian drone strikes have ranged increasingly far from the front line, targeting Russian vehicles, air defenses, and apparently a deep strike on Russian positions near Mariupol. Ukraine reports that Russia is planning to carry out additional threatening actions on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, specifically the use of drones. All reactors in the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant are now in a cold shutdown mode for the first time since 22, as the last one was taken off of its hot shutdown mode, which required more energy in order to keep it cool. However, Putin allegedly told the International Atomic Energy Agency recently that he plans to restore operation of at least one reactor, so stay tuned. We'll pause there for any questions before we move on.
Language, I'd like to take a closer look at Chasiv Yar. Interested in the number of close air support missions Russia has flown here, what advances they have made into Chasiv Yar, and how the Ukrainian defense of Chasiv Yar is going right now.
So we've seen a heavy amount of glide bombs. Currently, beyond that, which has been a factor for some time now, it's also the increased usage of drone-guided artillery, and specifically these grenade launchers, because, they're not shooting at a target they could see with their eyes, but they can still range, about 2 kilometers out. The Russians do have high ground to the east, so they get a little bit more distance, and they can use these as very rapid drone-guided artillery, essentially, or low-caliber drone-guided artillery. That seems to be the major issue currently right now, at least from Ukrainian troops there, while there continues to be airstrikes and just general artillery shelling otherwise. We'll get to a little bit later, but there seems to have been a minor decrease in Russian glide bomb usage here, supplanted by thermobaric artillery and other such things.
If Russia succeeds in overwhelming Chasiv Yar, where would they go next? And what advantage tactically does it give Russia?
So the benefit of Chasiv Yar is that it would give them high ground, which they could then use to shell the western larger city of Konstantinivka, as well as control more of the highways leading into it. And that's the main industrial line here from Slovyansk to Kramatorsk all the way down through this area towards Donetsk and whatnot. That seems to be the goal more so than anything else. Russia was successful in getting into the hills west of Bakhmut recently, which has allowed them the opportunity to then try and move further west here. So I imagine that's the goal overall.
And you mentioned that Russia had launched some assaults north-northeast of Soledar. This is to the north-northeast of Bakhmut. A bit in the rear. What precipitated these attacks?
So these have been intermittent in the past. I actually know a couple units here. It's unclear to me exactly what changed. There were some Ukrainian assaults here, so this might have been a Russian response to them. It could also be that we're just seeing more evidence of it, but I've seen no evidence to suggest the front lines have changed materially in either way. So beyond that, I'm just not super clear. There's been some increase in Ukrainian drone strikes here on artillery in the rear, so this could have been a response to that. But beyond that, your guess is as good as mine.
Thanks, Language. To Lexicon, please. Lexicon will be patient as you wrestle with your microphone and look for a way to unlock your audio. We are looking forward to hearing from you.
You know, Alan, while I sometimes find if I have another topic that it unlocks Lexicon's mic for her. So I'm just going to ask about what is happening with David Cameron. I've noticed that this escalation trope seems never mind. I'll get to
well,
that.
It's okay. You can ask that if I wonder
okay.
too. Go ahead
okay.
and then
just
I'll keep my
don't
mic
mute
down
yourself.
Low.
Good. Okay. Anyway, so my it seems as though this escalation phobia is spreading. I was very surprised at David Cameron. I thought he was made of sterner stuff. Do you have any idea what might be going on behind the scenes with that?
Sure. So we'll talk about it a bit later, but here as well, a lot of this is coming from the fact that the Ukraine government quickly seized on to the fact that, hey, you guys are worried about having foreign forces involved in NATO and all this stuff, but you just intercepted one of the largest missile and drone attacks that the world's seen in a single day, and we're all here the next day. And this all happened without, at least to my understanding, UK, US, I think there might have been a couple other participating nations, forces suffering casualties or risks of, escalation with Iran, despite the fact that, Iran's made some bellicose statements since then, it still remains pretty much the status quo. So it's, hey, right now our major issues are air defense, and we're having the same Shahids and missiles hit us. What's the big difference? And I think that this is David Cameron trying to get out and mean and make the statement that you cannot equivocate between these two things. Whether he's correct or not, I'll leave to individual interpretation, but that seems to be the political aspect that he's advancing very quickly before the narrative starts to gain ground.
Thank you. Yeah, that doesn't, that sounds believable. Let's, over to you, Lexicon.
Yeah, well, thanks for that one, too. I mean, I see him, like, he made all those big speeches. He flew across the ocean, got really stiffed badly. And then I see him on that LBC thing, backing off, supposedly being skewered by the interviewer and backing totally off. And as you say, oh, no way, it's not the same thing at all. NATO cannot be engaging Russia directly, or he finally spit it out. So lots of talk. Anyway, I was interested in Bilahorivka, which is White Mountain or Hill. I've lost track now. I got a lot going on here. So I sort of lost track where it is. I mean, I see it all the time. I just recently saw somebody talking about it and talking about Ukraine. And maybe you've spoken about it too, because I must say I'm a little bit distracted. So this is a very interesting place. It looks that white hill. It looks like the White Cliffs of Dover. It's also, I'm not sure if it's a sort of a chalk core. Anyway, a buildup of a white chalky substance. So Ukraine's got a height there. And so I just wondered if you heard about that, if you can talk about it. Apparently, there was terrifically huge assaults by the Russians. Please tell me if you've already spoken about it. Looks like Ukraine may have also used some air support, I'm not sure, to beat that back. But it looks like something that they're intent on coming back on. Can you talk about operationally what's the importance and what's going on there, if you're aware of it? And as I say, tell me if I didn't, if you already talked. And if I don't get this turned off, I'll lower it down. But if I don't get it, the mute turned off, get myself muted, please feel free to mute me. Thank you.
Sure. So unfortunately, I don't have the exact map up right now. There's a bunch of towns in Ukraine called Bilhorivka. It's like that and Oleksandrivka, because I guess Alexander the Great was a pretty cool guy and people like his name around the world. Seem to be the most popular of all these villages. So I'm not 100% sure on which one you're talking about. That big rocket, guided, or that big MLRS-assisted strike to the northwest of Soledar was, I believe, around Bilhorivka. So that could be the one that you're discussing. There's also, there's others in the country, so I would have to know the region itself.
Okay, then I'll see if I can get something more. But it just seemed like a major operation, and that reporting from Ukraine talked about it. So I thought there was some reason it was a bigger Horivka than all the other little ones, a bigger white mound.
Yeah, well, it's just a very popular name for villages there. And so If you can find the oblast or the region it was in, I might be able to comment more on it. Otherwise, I'm going to assume it's this one. There's also Bohdanivka, which is the suburb currently being fought over, or, you know, contested, I should say, to the northeast of Chasiv Yar. But that's, you know, also a different name, right? So, and I don't believe that translates to White Town. So I'm sure you're right.
No, this is White Mountain. Yeah, wait. Okay, thank you.
Yep, Furious, don't mute your mic. Stay with us. Language, I think that the Bilohorivka that Furious is speaking about is in Luhansk. And I'll send a link to the specific location. But it's a... I'm not exactly sure what Russian success here would allow Russian forces to do. This is a steep escarpment.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about then. So yeah. the one to the northeast of Siversk, closer towards Lysychansk and Severodonetsk, that's been contested for a year and a half, 2 years now. So no real major changes. This is the one where Russia recently increased its strikes. They launched a couple more assaults on what had otherwise been a pretty quiet front. And then more recently, we've seen a consequent increase in Ukrainian drone strikes or drone-guided strikes on vehicles behind the front line. I haven't seen any indications of major changes here otherwise. It's more just like they're targeting it more compared to the previous null state, which was essentially very quiet comparatively. But that hasn't translated to any major changes on the front line that I've seen.
Any idea why Russia would focus attacks at this particular place in Luhansk?
I suspect that Russia is just generally trying to figure out any place it can get a breakthrough currently. That's been the case for a couple of months now. Trying to seek both, especially, although we'll talk about that later, so I'll say that, you know, political inaction in the U.S. and, you know, the lack of munitions on the Ukraine side, the idea being that this is Russia's best opportunity to surge forward and find some sort of place for a breakthrough and then exploit it, which they can turn into both popular support at home as well as political support in Western nations or European nations that might be more amenable to Russian propaganda. So I think this is the same thing we're seeing. We saw in New Kupiansk, near Kremina. We're seeing it elsewhere. Like, the Russian goal is, let's find something we can grab onto so then we can turn around and say how we're winning. It doesn't really matter the town or village itself, in so much as just we have taken a town and, you know, we are fated for success no matter what.
It's possible that the United States will resume military aid to Ukraine in the next 14 days. I'm going to give myself that long a window. I don't think it's actually going to happen this week. Congress is going into recess again on April 19, means time is short. I know that Speaker Johnson has promised votes this week.
Let's talk about that at the end when it comes up. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about it twice, if that's okay.
Oh, sure, we can talk about it at the end. But
jumping ahead a little bit on me.
Okay. That was just a way to introduce a quick question, but maybe we can reserve that to the end as well. You tell me. I just wanted to ask you, what is your assessment of the damage done to the Ukrainian military tactically all along the line of engagement by this very long delay in military supply to Ukraine from the United States?
I imagine that it's one of the principal factors involved in the loss of Avdiivka. Really, the major factor there was a lack of artillery munitions, as well as other such aspects, which has led to increased casualties. It's that simple. You know, this trip, I think we're coming up on like 7 months, 8 months of arguable inaction. that has directly translated to Russia having the capability to launch these large assaults without being immediately targeted by artillery, as had been the case prior. So that's the long and the short of it. More Ukrainian deaths, more land lost, and the largest aspect of that is the consequent decrease in munitions.
Yeah. So, Language, you want to move on from here. Please go right ahead.
Sure thing. Let me get set up and moving on down towards Kherson. Russia launched four assaults towards the Krynky bridgehead with no observed effect. Russian and Ukrainian drones continue to operate on both sides of the river. A lot of Russian drone targeting around Berislav and mostly hitting what few civilians still remain in that riverside larger village. And the SBU arrested a would-be assassination attempt on the Kherson region military head, allegedly supported by the FSB. It's unclear exactly how many people were involved. In Odessa, the Black Sea, and Crimea, there is one current Russian warship out in the Black Sea, with none in Azov. Russia launched two KH-59 missiles towards Odessa, which were intercepted. Meanwhile, separately, a Ukrainian radar was destroyed southwest of Odessa. Russia is reportedly strengthening its aviation presence in the Black Sea to compensate for the reduction in Russian naval activity. And Ukraine reportedly struck a meeting of high-level Russian officers in Crimea, specifically targeting the leadership of the 810th Marine Brigade, which has already been pretty badly mauled. And the latest variants of the Ukrainian so-called Sea Baby, or unmanned surface vehicle drone, USV drones, reportedly can carry some 900 kilograms or 1 ton of explosives at distances of up to 1,000 kilometers. Moving to Russia, Russia has restored the capacity of some refineries following Ukraine strikes, going from about 14% to 10% offline. This has been impeded by Western sanctions and components, but Russia is still finding ways to get around them. Russia is reportedly trying to incentivize military service with financial exemptions on loan repayments and credit card debt for active soldiers, as well as prohibiting firing the widows of Russian servicemen for a year following their spouse's death. This appears to be a short-term rather than long-term solution, given a variety of economic knock-on effects. Russia is also reportedly recruiting women from penal colonies for military service. Specifically, they're asking for medics, snipers. A lot of that's kind of harkening back to, Russian mythos and utilization of female fighters during the Second World War, among other things. They're promising shorter sentences or commuted sentences and money. However, this has been widely reported by previous female soldiers in the Russian military. It's a noted culture of sexual predation from Russian officers towards female soldiers. I don't believe that's exactly hidden knowledge, especially among women in Russia at this point, those considering military service especially. So it remains to be seen how this sort of move will be interpreted. And Russia has reportedly stopped military rotations of naval personnel to Syria, with all troops instead being sent to Ukraine, sent to heavily reinforce the mauled Russian Marine units, such as the 155th, and we're seeing troops come from the Far East, from the Pacific Fleet, so on and so forth. In general, over the last day, Ukrainian troops launched some 22 airstrikes, while Russian forces conducted 93, including drones, and 98 rocket artillery strikes. Yesterday, Ukrainian troops eliminated some 770 soldiers, for a total of 454,420, average for over the last 7 days of 860 a day, 31 armored vehicles, 6 tanks, 41 artillery guns, 51 cars, trucks, ATVs, and motorcycles, and 31 drones for an estimated cost of about $80 million, a little less than the average of $100 million a day for the last 30 days. Overseas, following a House GOP meeting, it's reported that the Ukrainian aid bill, among others, may be submitted as a separate bill in the coming days or weeks. The specifics of timing and amendment modification remain unclear. Per the leaked proposal, $19.85 billion would be for U.S. stockpile replenishment, as we send stuff to Ukraine, $14.8 billion for U.S. Department of Defense operations in Europe, which was included in the prior bill. There's been a lot of overlap there between our operations in Europe, training and other factors going to Ukraine. $13.8 billion for USAI, which is directly purchasing weapons from U.S. manufacturers for Ukraine. $7.85 billion in direct financial support for the Ukraine government, and as well as another rider of $8 million for Inspector General operations, which provide accountability for aid sent. The total, $48.43 billion. There is speculation on an additional amount in humanitarian aid, as some $25 billion from the Senate combined bill doesn't appear to be on here, although right now we don't have a ton of information. Otherwise, this broadly aligns. There's also separate riders for the bills that were proposed for Israel aid and Taiwan, among others. The promise of an additional Patriot system from Germany was received positively in Ukraine, stating that it will take time for the battery to arrive. Ukrainian pilots who recently completed their first stage of training on F-16s in the United Kingdom will continue training in France. The UK foreign minister stated that it is impossible for UK aircraft to intercept drones and missiles over Ukraine due to the potential for, quote, dangerous escalation with Russia, unquote, in contrast to the mission intercepting IRGC missiles. The UK officially handed over two retired minesweepers to the Ukrainian Navy, which are currently located in Portsmouth. It is very unlikely that they are going to see action in the Black Sea at any point in the near future. Norway will reportedly supply some 22 F-16s to Ukraine, of which at least 10 are fully serviceable, and the status of the other 12 is not currently known. It will not happen before July. Denmark will allocate $43 million for reconstruction and business development in Ukraine. The Netherlands will allocate €4.4 billion to Ukraine over the next 2 years for defense. And the U.S. Treasury Department has introduced a ban on the supply of aluminum, copper, and nickel, which is produced in Russia going forward, including on global metal exchanges. And with that, that should be about it. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Language, what do you make of the back and forth in the House today? Republicans held a closed-door conference. The speaker has spoken about dividing these bills, seeking three or four different votes on the House floor this week. Isn't this going to lead to more delay?
Probably. I wouldn't be surprised. I think there's a political calculus. Because there have been some holdouts in the Democrat caucus who have not supported the discharge petition, chiefly because there's aid to Israel in there, which they are opposed to for a variety of reasons. This may be an attempt to try and get a board or get something on the record where they're saying, oh, well, we're trying to pass things now because this is something that's broadly popular among the U.S. electorate. And after this terrible attack on Israel, look, it's the our political opponents in the Democratic Party who are not supporting it because they know that's, there'll be some controversy there as well. There's also the fact that they can say, look at all we've done, and we've been able to support military aid, especially now coming on the aftermath of a fairly major military activity over the weekend with Iran's very large drone and missile attack. It's the fact that they're realizing that this could otherwise become a bludgeon to them, where they're saying, oh, Biden administration wanted to send this aid, but it hasn't been sent, and now it's all the GOP's fault. I think there's also the aspect, and we'll have to see what happens with the humanitarian aspect. There's like about $25 billion that seem to be missing here. There's been recent statements from former President Trump, who is known to have discussed this at length with certain elements of the House Freedom Caucus and whatnot about, oh, well, we can turn this into a loan. We don't really have a huge amount of details, but this might be a way for Speaker Johnson to try and keep his seat while also actually passing this broadly popular legislation and avoiding a insurgency from his own party by saying, well, you're a person of interest, Donald Trump is supporting this. So really it's all kosher now, because there's been considerable statements made that has been a large impediment to this in the past. I'll believe it when it happens, but we seem to be seeing some positive action, which is better than none. There's been some responses from the Biden administration pushing back on separating any bills out. We'll just have to see how it develops. I have no doubt it's going to take longer than we'd like, but let's not let perfect be the enemy of good.
You have to assume that 155 millimeter artillery munitions would be a part of the resumption of American aid to Ukraine, as well as additional air defense missiles and that kind of thing. But just speaking about artillery munitions for the moment, language, has Europe succeeded in stepping into the gap created by the failure of the United States to continuously supply Ukraine with what it needs? Where do we stand in terms of delivery of 155 millimeter artillery shells to Ukraine?
So that's an ongoing process. I believe the Czechs mentioned that there was another 180,000 shells or part of the 1 million that they had previously discussed being able to source, that with additional financial support they could get their hands on, that some deliberations already been completed on that. This is a process. It's not going to happen nearly as fast as we'd like, although we are seeing more Ukrainian artillery usage at the front lines, which is likely because they anticipate that these shells will eventually come. Separately, there was a fire up in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton today. They're pretty close to each other, at or immediately around the 155 millimeter plant or the plant that produces them. I haven't seen any explanations on exactly what's going on there. I believe the fire did get put out. So keep an eye on that. That might serve, depending on what happened, as an impediment for U.S. production, as that was one of the main facilities that we were scaling things up at.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be an impediment in any way. A small fire, it was extinguished. Munition manufacture is dangerous. Coincidentally, the president will be in Scranton tomorrow making a speech. Completely unrelated, fire in a 155 millimeter munitions factory, and the president's visit to Scranton tomorrow. As I say, completely unrelated. Not the kind of fire that you see in Russia. It's just a coincidental event. Language, have you looked also at the situation in Kherson on the south bank of the Dnipro? What's happening in Kryvyi, Oleshki? How are the handful of Ukrainian troops on the south bank doing there?
So the situation there remains fairly steady and without any major change. We see intermittently, depending on the day, somewhere between 0 and 5 Russian assaults. These haven't really proven to be successful because the Ukrainians target them with drones and drone-guided artillery, especially. There's been some more drone strikes in areas along the river and some of these deltas where, forces from either side are encamped or landing boats. But the whole purpose there, as best as I can tell, is it's not for Ukraine to suddenly land tanks and have their own little D-Day and storm across all the way down to Crimea, which not going to happen, but more so to draw in Russian forces and destroy them with support from their own artillery on the far bank. Also because Ukraine, for a variety of reasons, seems to enjoy some advantage in terms of drone and indirect fire work here. So they've been able to pretty badly maul the already previously depleted Russian units here. This is more of that bite and hold approach and force them to come to you rather than bite and take more. It's to attrit Russian forces in the area. That really hasn't changed in any major sense, although obviously the circumstances for the Ukraine troops there are also not great, due to the fact that there's a river between them and friendly lines. They are marginally better than they were during the winter when environmental factors were having a huge role as well.
What about Russian artillery shelling of Kherson? Continuous use of glide bombs. Is Russia attempting to level Kherson as it is attempting to level Kharkiv all the way at the other end of the line of engagement?
So this is actually, to my knowledge, the first place that Russia started using glide bombs en masse, and this would have been in the fall, late summer of last year. That was somewhat impeded by Ukrainian shootdowns of Russian combat aircraft in the region, but Russia still has its air bases in Crimea, which it can use to launch glide bombs more easily here than in some other regions. So that kind of waxes and wanes. This was a major concern of mine way, way back after Kherson was liberated, that Russian forces would set up on the South Bank and just blast it to oblivion. That has waxed and waned. The massive flooding after the destruction of Kakhovka Dam hasn't really helped Russia's ability to just emplace the fact that they also have to worry about troops closer to them. And now with the considerable increase in drone activity now versus, say, 2022, it means that these same artillery systems can be targeted a little more effectively, which leaves the Russians with that waxing and waning glide bomb usage. I don't know exactly where that will go one way or the other. I imagine it's going to be a fairly consistent pace, but this has been the reality in Kherson for, I'd say, well over a year, because they're within, in some extreme cases, sniper range on the riverbank, let alone mortar, artillery, and now glide bomb strikes.
We saw a report earlier today of a Ukrainian deep strike against a command headquarters in Crimea. Apparently, high-level Russian military officials were in attendance at a meeting there, but we haven't seen a lot of reports of continued Ukrainian deep strikes. What is your expectation of Ukraine carrying out this war of this strategic war of drone attacks, whether they are against Russian oil refineries inside Russia, against Russian command posts in occupied Ukraine? Is Ukraine conserving what it needs to conduct these strikes?
If I was a betting man, they're probably using things as fast as they can source them. I don't think they're building up, on a grand scale beyond, what they need for the next strike. They have made a lot of statements at the end of last year, beginning of this year, that they're increasing their production of medium and long-range strike options. The statements more recently about cruise missiles, the Neptunes and whatnot, because those are just more effective for a variety of reasons than drones, especially when you start getting into these extended ranges, the amount of energy and resources you spend on a jet-powered drone carrying explosives starts to get pretty equivalent to a cruise missile for a variety of technical purposes. It seems that Russia or Ukraine is focusing on that as well. We'll just have to see. They said that they were going to increase their production by 10 times this year. I don't know what the current production is. That figure is kind of meaningless to me, but we'll just have to wait and see. I imagine this is going to continue to be a development, though. I would be astonished if Ukraine started decreasing its production for these things, especially as they're seeing it have impacts in Russia and also in the occupied territories.
Do we know whether or not Russia's strikes at Ukraine power infrastructure has affected a supply of electricity to Ukraine's defense manufacturing?
I mean, to an extent, yes, but right now, the big saving grace is the 1,700 megawatt line. So I think that's 1.7 gigawatts, if I'm getting it right, of power coming in from Europe. The exact amount, they used to be saying, oh, this is how much we use. This is how much of excess power we had returned to Europe. They stopped reporting that, which leads me to believe they're probably using as much as they can in order to keep the lights on. But as far as the specifics on how much this is going to impede things, couldn't tell you. If I'm a betting man, Ukraine will probably restrict power to civilian infrastructure, as we've seen with blackouts and whatnot, and prioritize things like facilities and military structures, as is what they did in the tail end of 2022 when we first started seeing these blackout regimes across the country.
Robin, that completes my questions for Language in tonight's military update. Language, thank you. Robin, maybe you have some additional questions?
No, I don't at the moment. I don't want to repeat what, the same questions I ask each week. But thank you. It's a very informative, Language. Does anyone else in the panel have any questions before we thank Language and let him get on with his life?
I don't see any hands raised. Language, do you want to give a quick summary of the status of the zero line, of the situation as you see it right now in Ukraine?
Sure. I think, I'm not going to say that Russia is going for broke, but they're definitely increasing the tempo of operations around Bakhmut, really Chasiv-Yar suburbs, and around Avdiivka. Among other areas in the front lines, and that seems to be a damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead type of approach, because we have seen a market increase in Russian vehicle losses and what appears to be an increase in unconventional vehicles being used, everything from basically trucks with, some sheets of metal welded to the top being used to drive towards a trench, which ended predictably poorly, to the ATVs, to motorcycles. The continued degradation of Russian equipment stockpiles because they feel that for a variety of reasons, now is the best time to go for broke rather than, say, a year from now. So hopefully with Western aid coming in the probably medium-term future, this, I'm not going to say it's the high watermark, but the rate of losses for Russian equipment is wildly unsustainable. Although we are seeing Ukrainian losses in terms of ground and whatnot as a result of these increased assaults, which I expect will continue for probably another couple of months if Russia is allowed to do so.
Language, we do have a late hand here from Stephen. Stephen, go ahead, please.
Many thanks for your excellent analysis. Have nothing to disagree with. I wonder if you share my puzzlement, though, in regards to this increased tempo of attack. Yes, they have been using, in some cases, significantly larger groupings, but not very significantly larger groupings. So I've noted up to 10 or so vehicles at a time. Sometimes or usually in columns, occasionally with mixed tanks, usually in the lead, followed by several BTRs and or other IFVs, BMPs, and similar. With pretty much universally terrible results. So the question is this: if they are willing to lose this much armor, why lose it over an extended period of time in such a piecemeal fashion? Why not concentrate it all in two or three major assaults and truly overwhelm? Because it just, they seem to always deploy just enough armor to either maybe drop off a handful of soldiers for a bridgehead that usually then gets annihilated with the loss of all other vehicles, either in depositing them or in withdrawal, or just annihilation on the way to the attempt to do that, which has, doesn't strike me as particularly good. And the areas in particular that I find most astonishing is east of Bilhorivka, the White Mountain. I mean, what an absolutely hopeless situation to assault in piecemeal groups that is, because even if they got to that, it's extremely steep. There's nowhere to hide. There are no points in the plain below it that you can use to you know, that. And also east of the Oskil Reservoir, north of Kremina, where, again, similar conditions of a very long plain, which is extremely well overwatched, just lead to results of what that I've described. It just doesn't seem, you know, yes, there have been very small piecemeal gains. Yes, they are attriting to a small degree, but it's not like these are sort of wild weasel attacks that are bringing out enemy, you know, obviously wild weasels to do with air defense, but they're not revelatory. They're not telling them anything, and they're not really gaining them anything, but they are losing them a great deal. Why not more concentrated attacks with a slower tempo at the same time as piecemeal smaller attacks just to maintain the front? Thank you.
Right. So I think this is I hesitate to say this, I'm going for broke, but I think this is Russia having sensed a bit of weakness lately, especially with the drawdown, slowdown in Western aid. And so they're saying, we will go for it now. Because prior, where a lot of Russian vehicles get destroyed is not in the assault, but as they gather for them. Because in the world of drones and drone-guided artillery, even when Ukraine doesn't have a huge amount of munitions available, they still say, oh, we see 20 vehicles getting in a group, getting ready to go. Yeah, that's worth it. It's fire. So that's been an aspect on top of, you know, FPV drones and what have you. So I think that's the other issue. We saw that north of Kupiansk where the Russians were. One day they'd say, oh, we have 500 tanks ready to storm down. And then anytime they got more than 10 together, they'd get targeted pretty aggressively. So in the modern world of artillery and drone-guided artillery and FPV strikes and all that, and as we start to move into night vision capable drones, which are becoming increasingly prevalent, striking at vehicles and equipment during the time where historically it's been the safest for them to move, the Russians realize we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. So either we launch these assaults with less equipment with the hope that then we're not going to be targeted as aggressively during the staging process, or we group everything together, suck the losses up, and then we actually have enough forces to break through. But neither of those seems to be a particularly fruitful long-term strategy. I think right now, I hesitate to say desperation, but I do think that the Russians feel like it's now or never, and that the situation for them, especially in terms of equipment, is not going to improve in the medium to long term. And so, especially as Ukraine aid starts to ramp up from the West, then the moment will pass, and then they won't have the ability to survive with these smaller assaults that thus far have not attracted enough attention. And then they won't be able to survive as easily with the larger assaults because there'll be enough ammo to strike them too, if that answers the question.
It does, rather. Thank you. Yes. So the issue that they are facing is accurate long-range fires, which is also what has prevented them from marshalling ammunition forward, because I think it was in the late autumn, early winter of 2022, we saw a large scale, well, extremely numerous destruction of ammunition dumps, forcing them to move those logistic hubs further and further back. Now, I think mostly either in Crimea itself or else in Russia. And the use of HIMARS, Storm Shadow, and other similar long-range systems, as well as perhaps Archers, Caesars, and Panzerhaubitzers, mean that they cannot marshal mobile equipment prior to mass attacks. Yeah, that makes considerable sense. What makes less sense is their use of this piecemeal approach, since it is so extraordinarily costly, but I accept your analysis. Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's great questions. I appreciate them.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for getting into the conversation here. Language, I want to remind listeners that you post your Monday night and Wednesday night military updates on SoundCloud. They're also archived on Maria Report's archive on Spotify. And ordinarily, you post the link to the interactive map along with the recording of the show, but that interactive map wasn't working tonight. However, I do encourage folks to go to SoundCloud, look for Language's post there. Language, remind us how we can find your archive on SoundCloud. Well, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe it's not on SoundCloud or Language. Maybe you are speaking into a muted mic.
Yeah, having possibly some connectivity issues on my end. I will throw up a link afterwards. I will take some time and upload the audio as well as the text so you can follow along with both. I'll pin the post. You can find it in my profile, and I'll throw it up in the nest here if I can get that done in the, you know, fairly, you know, next 10 minutes or so. And then my DMs are always open. As always, feel free to share. The more eyes on it, the more questions I can get. And comments, concerns, complaints, happy to hear them all. Because this is how we learn. Because if you don't understand something or it's unclear, well, it probably means there's another dozen people who don't as well. They're just too shy to say something. So, but with that, thank you guys so much for having me. And I will hopefully see and speak with all of you on Wednesday.
Thanks very much, Language, for your time here tonight. Thanks for everyone's questions.